Today is November 18th, 2005, and we're here with Commodore McLean in his home in Detroit. Sarah, I'd just like to start with a brief some details just of where you were born, the rank you retired at, and your current interaction with the Navy at this time.
Okay. I was born in Calgary, Alberta, and grew up in Lethbridge, Alberta, and joined the Navy from there when I was right after high school when I was 18. And I retired in 1996 as a Commodore. And my current involvement with the Navy is that I am a mentor and teacher at Naval Officers Training Center at Venture. And we teach navigation and collision avoidance and bridgemanship to young MARS officers.
In the summer of 1990, you just assumed command of HPCS Protector. Can you just give a brief description of what your duties and responsibilities entailed?
Well, previous to that, I was serving, I'd been serving the previous 3 years in Norfolk, Virginia, at SACLANT headquarters, as the director of exercises, and that summer, the summer of 1990, I came back to Halifax in June and took command of Protector, and of course that entails everything. You are the commanding officer, so everybody and everything in that ship is subject to your commands and orders and direction. And we were ostensibly going to be leaving within a month or two to go to a large exercise in the Norwegian Sea. And within a couple of weeks of getting there, we were told that we were in fact not going to go to that exercise, and that the three ships, Athabasca, Terra Nova, and Protector, would be heading to the Persian Gulf.
When was the first time you, or where was the first time you heard that Protector was going to be going to? Was it at this moment, or?
Yeah, it was about, I'm trying to remember the exact date, but it was sometime in July, and then Commodore Summers, who was going to go, he was the fleet commander of the Atlantic Fleet at that time, and he was meant to be deploying with us for this large exercise. He was going to be the OTC, the Officer in Tactical Command. And so he called me to his office one day and told me that, in fact, we were not going to be going to that exercise, that he'd just been given the word that we were likely going to be going to the Gulf. And at that point, they had just a warning order, which means the Navy had been given notice by the government to just to stand by and to make some preparations in the event that we were then later tasked. So we weren't actually at that point specifically tasked to be going, but we were tasked to get ready in case we were told to go.
How did your family take it when you told them the news, these flight change of plans?
Well, that was interesting because my at that point our daughters were both married and lived here in Victoria. And our son was then the only child living at home, and he was just starting university at St. Mary's University in Halifax as a first-year university student. So he and I are very, very close. We were involved in a lot of sports over the years. I coached every sport known to man that he played, which was most of them. So anyway, we're extremely close, and he was very upset. My wife took it in stride, like all Navy wives, bless their hearts, are able to do. So we had just bought a new house, and we were still kind of moving in. Only I never got to the house. I was basically in the ship 24 hours a day getting everything ready to go. So she was doing all that herself, which included recarpeting the whole house and repainting the whole house, getting all our stuff from Virginia and so on. So they were busy, but my son was visibly upset by the fact that his dad was heading off to a potential war. In fact, there was a picture of he and I and my wife in the newspaper there the day we left. And he was in tears, and he's a jock, so tears weren't usually his in his vocabulary.
When I'm sure you had to put some thought into how you're going to officially break the news to your crew. They must have heard whispers and rumors around Doc Yerrick.
Yeah, that was interesting. And what made that even more interesting was that because I had only just taken command, and I'd been out of the country for 3 years, and prior to that, I was serving on the West Coast. So I knew no one, basically, not one person in that group. I didn't know the executive officer. I didn't know any of the officers. I didn't know anyone, and so which meant they didn't know me. So we were all strangers, and that was an interesting position to be in, because I had to speak to them in a way that and convince them in their minds that they were about to go off on some potentially very dangerous mission with someone that they trusted as their commanding officer. So that was on my mind a lot, actually, and I spent a lot of time thinking about how to approach that and how to speak to that group of people and give them confidence to go off and do what we were going to do. And on top of that, of course, the ship's company grew from 200, its normal size of 250, to about 450. So there were another additional 200 people coming into the ship that were going to become members of the ship's company. So everything was in turmoil in terms of there were all kinds of new faces in the ship, and right up to and including a new captain. So I met with them fairly as soon as I found out, and I had permission to speak to them about it. Then I mustered the whole ship's company in the hangar, and gave them a brief on what we were, what it was looking like that we were likely to be doing, and we went from there. So we met regularly. I'd call these meetings at the ship's company when there was something of importance to tell all of them, and of course, one of the major things you're trying to do in that sort of situation is stifle the rumors, because they are problematic. People start believing things that aren't true, and before long these things run through the ship's company, and there's all kinds of problems created by that. So better to keep them informed of the truth and what's actually happening, and for them to actually feel like they're being kept informed. And then when they hear these wild rumors get started somewhere in the dockyard or in the newspaper or wherever, they don't have to immediately sort of glom onto them as true, and then there's a lot of damage control that has to be done to take care of those things, to convince them and their families that that's not the situation. So better to keep them informed. Everybody's performing better if they know what's going on and why they're doing it. So we had a lot of meetings.
These extra people on board, what trades or what were their intended purpose or roles going to be?
Well, they were mostly, there were a number of groups. You could put it into several pieces. One was that the ship was going to carry 4 Sea King helicopters, which had never been done before. The ships were built to carry 3, but very seldom carried 3. Usually 2 was about all we could muster up from Shearwater for the AOR, plus all the destroyers getting theirs, the frigates and so on. So we were going to put 4 aircraft in there, so we needed more air crew. We were the first time ever authorized to conduct what is known as second-line maintenance on the helicopters, which included things like changing engines and so on in the Sea Kings and doing fairly major overhauls of the aircraft that up till then was only ever done at Shearwater. Those were the rules. So we only did kind of first-line maintenance at sea, even in the AOR, and the rest was done ashore. So that meant I needed more air technicians, some additional air trades, and some more senior people in a number of the trades, because we were going to be doing much more challenging technical work on those helicopters. So that was the first group. The second was that we armed the ship. So we put the 3-inch 50 gun back on the bow. We put 2 40-millimeter Bofors on the deck in front of the bridge. 50-caliber machine guns were mounted in five or six different places, I guess. And then we got decoy systems, anti-ship missile defense decoy systems like Shield and Super Arbok, which meant you needed weapons. They're basically rocket systems, and so you need technicians for that. So there was a whole bunch of new people there, and gunners and so on to fire the weapons. Then we needed we put a tactical data system in the ship, which was not there before, and a number of electronic warfare systems, and a new radar, and all new satellite communications. And so all of those things required people. And then the third group was the Army. And we took, as part of our missile defense system, we took a number of Army folks from Chatham, New Brunswick, and their anti-aircraft missiles that they fired. So I had two groups on board, one that would be on top of the hangar with the missile launcher up there, and one that would be on the forecastle, would close up on the forecastle at action stations, and obviously a group of people to fire missiles up there. So there was a fairly large bunch of Army folks, and that would be the largest that would take care of most of those extra 200 people. And then some additional people in the regular trades we had on board, bosuns and supply techs and so on, because of the volume of work we were going to have to do. So there was a slight increase there as well. So that's why the ship's company almost doubled in about 3 weeks.
Did you bring any press members with you, or did you acquire them?
I'm trying to remember. I don't think any sailed with us. I don't think, but I could be wrong. I'm not sure, but for sure, we had press on board after we left Gibraltar, I think, and then the numbers grew once we got to the Gulf. We had a lot of press on board, both print media, radio, and television, and because of the two destroyers were full as well, because they got some of these additional systems as well, and they had some Army folks to fire missiles and so on, not as many as I did, but they were absolutely full. So the press fanned out to those, to Terra Nova and Athabascan from time to time, quite regularly, but they lived on board Protector, and I had the helicopters to fly people around as well, and they would, different ones were coming to Bahrain and getting on board there. And so I'd be picking them up, and basically we took care of the press for the whole time that we were there. So they lived on board Protector and did a lot of stories from there as well.
In your mind, when you were getting ready to deploy, what were some of the key obstacles that stuck out in your mind that would possibly affect your ability to leave on time?
Well, there were a lot in Protector. We, firstly, fitting all those new systems that we got. I didn't even have a combat systems engineer then, because AORs didn't have combat systems engineers. So I just had a combat officer and myself making decisions about where all this equipment should be fitted. Some of that was being, you know, done ashore by the engineers and so on. But in the end, it was my decision and my combat officers to do the best we could to put the various bits and pieces of equipment that were being fitted in a place where they would be not mutually interfering with each other, and of you know, the best place to put them to actually be used to best purpose for protecting Protector. So there was a huge amount of stuff going on in the ship, and not only the fitting of all those weapon systems and radars and EW systems and so on, but we were also loading the ship with an amazing amount of things, ammunition. We had to unload, for instance, all the torpedoes that we had on board in the magazines that I was carrying for the rest of the fleet. And remember that we'd already loaded up on quite a bit of stuff for the destroyers that we were going off to this exercise in the North Norwegian Sea, so we had to get rid of most of that. Get rid of the torpedoes and stuff that we carried in our regular wartime magazine load, because there was no submarine threat there, so it was taking up a lot of space. And I was going to be taking a lot more ammunition. For instance, we took every Sea Sparrow missile in the Canadian Navy inventory, except for the ones that were on board Athabasca at the time. And that included the ones that were on the 280 on the West Coast. They took all her missiles off, put them on trains, and sent them to Halifax and put them in protector. Same with the other, anything that was in either the magazine out here or the Bedford magazine in Halifax, every missile came out of there and went on board protector. And then there was all the ammunition for the close-in weapon systems, the Vulcan Phalanx, which were newly fitted. They fitted one quickly to both Terra Nova and Athabasca, and they fitted two to protector. I didn't mention that in the weapons load. The close-in weapon systems were huge. Huge fits. And anyway, so we took all that ammunition. By the time we were finished loading, we had the ammunition in the magazines and protector was right to the deckhead and right to the doors. So it was the fullest little magazines had ever been. And of course, we're taking on fuel, cargo fuel, taking on all kinds of supplies, spare parts, a lot of aircraft spare parts. Spare parts for the ships, food, all the usual things that we would take, and then some, because we didn't know how long we'd be gone. We didn't know what the supply line was going to be to resupply us with those things. So the ship was filling up by the hour with ammunition, spare parts, food, fuel, and anything else we could lay our hands on. Medical supplies, because in the people thing I didn't mention, we took a full operating team. Nurses, surgeons, the whole works. So that was another bunch of people that came on board, and we took all their supplies as well. So there was a lot of stuff loaded up in the ship. And in the end, the ship had a draft of 34 feet the day we left. And the AORs had never, ever had a 34-foot draft before, ever. In fact, I asked my navigator the day I left. We were leaving. We were actually pulling away from the pier with all the dignitaries waiting on the saluting dais to say goodbye to us. And I asked the navigator how the ship handled at 34 feet of draft. And he said, "I have no idea, sir, because I've checked the navigation data book, and the ship's never, ever been this deep." So that tells you how much stuff we put on board. It was a lot. Not to mention an extra 200 people.
Yeah, 200 extra mouths to eat. On the way over, your ship did workups. Maybe you can just give me an idea of the kind of preparations you did to get ready for workups and the workups experience itself.
Well, the ship before we... Before I took command in this was late June, the ship was in fact worked up. It was an operational AOR, so they'd done workups and all that sort of thing sometime in about a year before, I believe, and that was a fully operational AOR. However, it was really about all these new systems we put on board, all the weapon systems, all the sensors. So we and the air crew, an increased air crew. A lot of them were not all that experienced in flying off ships, and they were qualified, but just barely, and in some cases. And a lot of people new to the ship, all the Army folks, a number of the Air Force people, a number of the people who volunteered to come and be weapons operators and so on were new to that class of ship. So we had a whole lot of new people there, including myself, who'd never served in an AOR. And so we had to put together that whole package then. That's why we did a kind of a mini workup on the way over. It was less of a workup than a kind of an assist by the sea training staff. Firstly, we had to devise a watch and station bill that included action stations, because AORs didn't have action stations. They had replenishment stations, they had emergency stations, they had abandoned ship stations, but AORs had nothing to fight with, so they didn't have action stations until now. So we had to devise a plan, and the sea training coxswain and my coxswain and the XO and sea training XO and so on got together, and they spent a lot of time doing that, because they had to organize 400 people into a workable thing. And we had to add things like you needed personnel to reload the various anti-ship missile defense systems once you'd fired those rockets off. You got to put some more in there, and so all those positions had to be detailed in the watch and station bill, and where the Army folks were going to go and when and at what point in going to action stations, and what about all the air crew and the aircraft themselves, and the operations room was much more sophisticated than it had been a few weeks earlier. So we had a whole team in there. So there were a lot of things to be sorted out. So that's really why we did that kind of mini workups on the way across. And we got a little more practice at firing the various weapon systems and reloading them. The Army folks actually fired some missiles at some targets that we got to launch by an aircraft. So they could. Most of them had never fired a missile because they're quite expensive. And so they'd done it in a simulator, but they'd never actually fired a real missile. So they brought the other Army folks over from Athabasca and Terra Nova, and a British Army major was there he came on board to help teach these kids how to effectively fire those missiles. And so they camped out in Protector for a couple of days on the way across so that we could do all those extra firings and things like that. So that's really what it was about. It was a major sort of reorganization of the ship's company. And so it was like starting over for workups. But it was done very quickly, because we didn't have enough time to do 3 weeks worth like you'd normally do.
I suppose this is also a steep learning curve for the sea trainers themselves, because the equipment in the platform.
Yeah,
they're them too.
Yeah, in fact, it was quite interesting because I eventually got a combat systems engineer who was posted to the ship before we left, about a week or so, 2 weeks before we left, and he came from Ottawa, Lieutenant Commander McDougall, Dave McDougall, and he was luckily on the CPF project in Ottawa, so he knew a lot about these systems that we were quickly fitting in the ship, and none of the rest of us knew basically anything about them. And the sea trainers didn't either, because there were none in the fleet at that point. None of the CPFs had actually commissioned. So all this equipment was sitting on the shelf in St. John, New Brunswick, waiting to be fitted in Halifax and the other early CPFs. So none of that equipment had made it to the fleet yet. And so there was no one in the fleet that knew how to operate it. And what we got was Xerox copies of operators' manuals, and I read through several of them, things like the closing weapon system and the shield infrared protection system and things like that, because none of us had ever seen any of this stuff. So we fired those on the way across, but the sea trainers were just as unknowledgeable in these systems as we were. So it was a bit of a group grope, we trial and error. We fired things and then we tried it some other way and reloaded it some other way, and eventually by the time we got to the Gulf we were reasonably competent in these things. I would say by the time I finished my first patrol in the Gulf, which would have been late October or November, something like that. I came in from that first patrol, and I estimated that we were about 90% efficient with all these systems. And by the time we finished the next patrol, I figured we were about as good as we could be with what we had to work with and the knowledge we had on the systems and so on. I thought, you know, we're about there. We're about as good as we could be. But it took, you know, whatever it was, 4 weeks of getting over there and then two-week patrols before we were really, you know, comfortable with where we were with all this stuff.
What did a patrol entail?
Well, we all had... Canada undertook to keep two ships at sea all the time. That was the commitment they made to the U.S. Admiral commanding the multinational forces there. And so that meant two of the three ships had to be at sea all the time. And I took a regular rotation with the other ships. And the only difference was that when I was in my patrol area, in my box, I would be patrolling that area looking to intercept merchant ships that were passing through there to make sure that there was no illegal cargo on board. They weren't smuggling oil out. They weren't smuggling weapons into Iraq and so on. So I was doing exactly the same thing that destroyers were doing, which was intercepting, querying, and if necessary, boarding and searching merchant ships as they passed through the area. And but I had the additional job of being the only AOR in the Gulf, so the Americans didn't have one, the Brits didn't have one, nobody else had an AOR up there in the actual Gulf. So I fueled everybody. And I also provided an interim airport for the Brits when the Brits had to fly an aircraft up from outside the Gulf, maybe with some spare parts for one of their AAW ships that were up in the northern Gulf where I was. They wouldn't have the legs to get all the way up there, drop off the spare parts and get all the way back. So sometimes they would stop on board protector and we'd do what's called a hot fuel. So they kept the helicopter running and our folks would go out, give them some fuel, and then they can carry on back to where they were over in the Gulf of Oman. So we did that, and we did probably on average, I'm guessing a little bit, but I would say we did probably three RASs a day, fueling other ships. And then the other thing we had to do, of course, was when new stuff would arrive from Canada, be it additional food or spare parts or for something that had broken down in one of the ships or whatever, that stuff would show up in containers and so on, usually, and I would pick that up and then take it out and distribute it to the ships the next time I saw them for a RAS. So it was, we had a very full, the time at sea passed very quickly, actually, probably quicker for us than the destroyers, because we had the additional job of taking care of everybody from the point of view of fuel and taking care of our own ships in every sense of everything they needed. You know, we made sure we got for them and got to them. So the day was full for us. Nobody got bored, I don't think.
In my research for this paper, I kept coming across the term one-stop shop to describe Protector's role and its abilities to supply all the other ships.
Well, that's what those ships were built to do. They, the Protector and Preserver, especially. Provider was 10 years older. She was the first AOR in the Canadian fleet and somewhat less capable. She didn't have as many fueling rigs. She didn't have as much hangar capacity. There were a number of designs, things that after we had Provider for a number of years, they came up with better ideas and then built Preserver and Protector. And so we could take absolutely everything a group of four Canadian ships would require for a period of 3 months. And by that I mean enough food, enough spare parts, enough, paper towel, enough petroleum products, lubricants, things like that that they might need for generators, and so on, paint, you name it. I mean, we, you know, blankets, whatever. It is truly like a Canadian Tire and a superstore, grocery store put together. So the only thing that we would need to replenish ourselves in less than 3 months would be fresh vegetables, stuff like that, which, you know, has a shelf life that isn't all that long. But every other form of food, meat, canned goods, whatever, with those things we could carry 3 months worth. And then spare parts and so on, more than 3 months worth. Depends on what breaks down, but we had a pretty good load list, as it was called. And then in addition to that,